Seekers, Mike Malloy here. Boy, the Chick-fil-A madness goes on, doesn't it? Chick-fil-A put out a press release, or somebody did today, that said they had their biggest day in their history yesterday when all the bigots showed up to chow down on fat and grizzle. I'll tell you, you would think that Chick-fil-A would not want to make that public. It's just astonishing to me that a fast food restaurant would declare itself so happy because every goddamn bigot in America apparently showed up to buy a chunk of chicken from these freaks yesterday, and they're proud of that. You know, Kathy posted something at MikeMalloy.com today, her blog, about all this intolerant stuff, and she makes, of course, an excellent point about these right-wing Christian ass wipes are screaming. Oh, they're screaming about the intolerance of it all because people decided that Dan Cathy is a bigoted son of a bitch, that somehow we're being intolerant because we are not tolerating his bigotry. I mean, what the hell kind of reasoning? And somebody sent me this. I don't watch the Rupert Murdoch Terror Broadcast Network for a lot of reasons. Number one, I'm sane. But the ever clueless Steve Doocy this morning, I think Al Babe sent this to me, talking about the Chick-fil-A controversy. Have you ever seen Steve Doocy? I've only seen him on clips on old Rachel's program or who else? I've seen clips of him. He's a real freak. But this is what Doocy said. Remember, it wasn't just people supporting Dan Cathy for his Christian values. People not only supporting his Christian values, and they're closed on Sundays, but also just the CEO's right to say what he thinks. You know, a lot of people wound up going, I read in New York Post today about how a lot of people went over to New Jersey to a Chick-fil-A. And it wasn't to support the family values thing, but to support his right to say something because so many people on the left are so intolerant. You've got to be able to say in this country what you think. All right. Steve Doocy, bite me, you freak. God. Oh, I'd like to say something to you, Doocy, but, you know, I don't want to lose my right to be on some of these radio stations. I'll guarantee you, though, if I only worked on Sirius or XM, I'd tell you what you'd want to hear, you little twit. Steve Doocy. Oh, my God. From Ed in Arlington, Washington, he wrote, just read this and thought you'd get a laugh too. Quoting George Carlin from his book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? This is George Carlin. Quote, you know who I pray to? Joe Pesci. He looks like a guy who can get things done. Joe Pesci doesn't F around. For years, I asked God to do something about my noisy neighbor with the barking dog. Joe Pesci straightened that CSR out with one visit. And here's Ed's favorite. Quote, if Jesus had been killed just 20 years ago, little Catholic girls would be running around with a tiny silver electric chair around their necks. Ed in Arlington, Virginia, or Arlington, Washington. Oh, my God. Oh, don't you, I mean, seriously, don't you miss George Carlin? Whew. I have something I want to share with you a little bit later tonight, something Derek Jensen wrote that Al sent to me. I was talking about hope the other night. You know, somebody asked me, well, you know, what are you? I said, well, you know, I still have hope that things will turn around. I'm going to share this with you. Maybe at the bottom of this hour, what Derek Jensen says, wrote about hope in an essay of his a couple of years ago. I love this story. U.S. government's only facility for handling, processing, and storing weapons-grade uranium was invaded by three anti-nuke activists, including an 82-year-old nun. God bless her. I mean, I'll just toss it out there. It's a Malloy benediction for someone. Obviously, the woman thinks she's married to Jesus, and that's okay with me. She invaded, she and her two pals, her partners in crime. Now, the sad part is she'll probably go to prison for the rest of her natural life. But the WSI Oak Ridge, the contractor responsible for protecting the facility at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and it's owned by the international security firm G4S, which was the same security firm that couldn't provide security at the London Olympic Games, right? Are these people winners or effing what, right? So a nun, an 84-year-old nun, breaks into the facility. She and her two pals cut through perimeter fences to reach the outer wall of a building where highly enriched uranium is stored. The activists then painted slogans and threw what they said was human blood on the walls. Woo! While moving between the perimeter fences, the activists triggered sensors, which alerted security personnel. However, officials concluded that the intruders were able to reach the building's walls before security personnel got to them. Well, hell yeah, they were watching porn on their little local laptops. Of course, what the hell are they going to do? Oh, somebody broke in. Well, wait a minute, this is a good part. Ellen Barfield, a spokeswoman for the activists who call themselves Transform Now Plowshares. They were arrested and charged by federal authorities with vandalism and criminal trespass. The three identified as Megan Rice, 82, Michael Wally, 63, Greg Obed, 57, were being held in custody. They were scheduled to appear in court in the next few days. The spokeswoman, Ellen Barfield, forwarded a statement from the group in which they said they had passed through four fences and walked for over 2 hours before reaching the uranium storage building, upon which they then hung banners and strung crime scene tape. Almost enough to make me want to join a nunnery. You gotta love these people, right? Officials said that the storage building itself, which was built after September 11, 2001, was designed with extra and modern security features and that its contents were not compromised. Oh, my God. Now, the story's out. So where are the terrorists? I mean, if three people, one of whom is 82, the other one's 63, and the other one's 57, with a pair of bolt cutters can get into a goddamn nuclear storage facility? Wow!
A spokeswoman for G4S Security declined to comment and referred inquiries to government spokespeople.
Well, anyway, to raise a glass to Megan Rice, Michael Wally, and Greg Obed, Bjorki Obed, I think that's how you pronounce the first half of his last name, Megan Rice, 82, Michael Wally, 63, Greg Bjorki Obed, 57. Although the security breach occurred overnight last Friday, officials confirmed that the shutdown, which applies to all nuclear operations at this site, did not begin until Wednesday. Of course not. Officials said that it was expected to continue into next week, the shutdown. In the meantime, personnel at the facility would be given additional security training.
What? How about some security training? Bless you, Ms. Nunn,
and your two cohorts bless you entirely. Hell, the next time you go to confession, let me know. I'll do your acts of contrition. I'll do your Our Fathers, and I'll do your Hail Marys. Amen.
Let Mike do it for you. It's Mike Malloy.
Look at the state of the world that we live in, where no one gives a damn about the future of children. Just building a castle.
21 past the hour. Can you imagine something like the following happening in the United States under any president, Democrat or Republican? This happened in Brazil. A federal court in Brazil has given Chevron and Transocean, their drilling company, 30 days to suspend all petroleum drilling and transportation operations in Brazil until investigations are completed into two oil spills off the coast of Rio de Janeiro. The court said in a statement posted yesterday on its website that each company will be fined 500 million reals, or about $244 million, for each day they fail to comply with the suspension. $244 million a day. You gotta love it. About 155,000 gallons of crude oil began seeping from cracks in the ocean floor. Sounds familiar. At the site of a Chevron appraisal well in November, Chevron has placed the amount of oil that leaked at 110,000 gallons. We're going to argue about that 45,000 gallons, you half-witted bastards. 2 weeks later, the National Petroleum Agency said the seepage was under control. But in March, oil again started leaking, and Chevron again suspended production in the field. The judge said in his ruling, quote, two environmental accidents in the space of just 4 months and the lack of equipment needed to identify the origin of the leaks and contain them shows that the two companies do not have the conditions necessary to operate the wells in an environmentally safe manner, end quote. Chevron said it planned to appeal the court's decision. Well, of course. I mean, what are they doing? They're just cracking open undersea rock where they can get to the oil. If it flows out and pollutes, so what? Not my problem. I don't live there. Right? Transocean said in a statement, quote, we maintain that this case is without merit and reiterate that Transocean crews acted responsibly and quickly, following the highest industry standards. They always say that, don't they? Huh? The head of the Petroleum Agency in Brazil said last month that the November spill involved about 25 safety violations, for which Chevron will be fined about $25 million, which is a maximum allowed under Brazilian law. Well, what is that? Lunch money for some of these rat bastards that run Chevron, right? The oil seeped from at least 7 breaks on the ocean floor, all within 50 meters of the wellhead. No oil reached Brazilian shores.
Not yet.
Earlier this year, Brazilian authorities banned Chevron from any new drilling or water injection activities at working wells in the country.
Water injection. Now, what would that be? Can you say fracking?
Of course you can.
In April, a Brazilian prosecutor filed an $11 billion lawsuit against Chevron and Transocean, which is based in Switzerland, for both the leak in November and the one in March, alleging that they caused environmental damage, blah, 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 blah. A month before that lawsuit, federal prosecutors filed criminal charges. Ah, now you're talking. Against 17 Chevron and Transocean executives, accusing them of environmental crimes, of misleading the Petroleum Agency about safety plans, and of not providing accurate information after the spill. The charges carry a maximum penalty of 31 years in prison. Oh, please. Let me pray to the God of the 82-year-old nun who broke into the Oak Ridge nuclear storage facility. God, or whatever your name is, please! Please let the judge sentence these goddamn people to prison! Forever! Hello? Hello? So, when is Barack Obama, or who's the head of the EPA, or I don't even know anymore. When is somebody in the American executive branch going to, when is somebody in the Justice Department, there you go, well, that's the executive branch. When is Eric Holder going to get a U.S. federal judge, one friendly to the idea of all of us not dying because of oil companies? And they're hard to find. Get a federal judge to order all these filthy goddamn oil companies to stop. Stop tomorrow. Stop immediately. Stop. Don't ever start again. Huh? No? Never happen? You don't think? Gee, I wonder why. I wonder why it would never happen. I mean, Obama has two daughters. Does Eric Holder have kids? I have kids. We'll be right back.
Twist the people's wrist. They're watching every move we make. We're all included on their list. The lunatics have taken over the asylum. Go nuclear, the cowboy told us. Disagree. That's when the madman flicks a switch.
Nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. All right, I want to share this with you. This is Alice in Arkansas sent this to me. She writes, last night you were talking about hope, and it reminded me of this essay by Derek Jensen. The most common words I hear spoken by any environmentalists anywhere are, we're effed. Most of these environmentalists are fighting desperately using whatever tools they have, or rather whatever legal tools they have, which means whatever tools those in power grant them the right to use, which means whatever tools will be ultimately ineffective. They're using those tools to try to protect some piece of ground, to try to stop the manufacture or release of poisons, to try to stop civilized humans from tormenting some group of plants or animals. Sometimes they're reduced to trying to protect just one tree. Here's how John Osborne, an extraordinary activist and friend, sums up his reasons for doing the work. Quote, as things become increasingly chaotic, I want to make sure some doors remain open. If grizzly bears are still alive in 20, 30, and 40 years, they may still be alive in 50. If they're gone in 20, they'll be gone forever, end quote. But no matter what environmentalists do, our best efforts are insufficient. We're losing badly on every front. Those in power are hell-bent on destroying the planet, and most people don't care. Frankly, I don't have much hope. But I think that's a good thing.
Hope is what keeps us chained to the system, the conglomerate of people and ideas and ideals that is causing the destruction of the earth. To start, there's a false hope that suddenly, somehow, the system may inexplicably change, or technology will save us, or the Great Mother, or beings from Alpha Centauri, or Jesus Christ, or Santa Claus. All of these false hopes lead to inaction, or at least to ineffectiveness. One reason my mother stayed with my abusive father was that there was no battered woman's shelter in the 50s and 60s. But another was her false hope that he would change. False hope binds us to unlivable situations and blind us to real possibilities. Does anyone really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anyone really believe that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? If only we get a Democrat in the White House, things would be okay. If only we pass this or that piece of legislation, things would be okay. If only we defeat this or that piece of legislation, things would be okay. Nonsense. Things will not be okay. They're already not okay. And they're getting worse. Rapidly. But it isn't only false hopes that keeps those who go along enchained. It is hope itself. Hope, we are told, is our beacon in the dark. It is our light at the end of a long, dark tunnel. It is the beam of light that makes its way into our prison cells. It is our reason for persevering, our protection against despair, which must be avoided at all costs. How can we continue if we do not have hope? We've all been taught that hope in some future condition, like hope in some future heaven, is and must be our refuge in current sorrow. I'm sure you remember the story of Pandora. She was given a tightly sealed box and was told never to open it. But being curious, she did, and out flew plagues, sorrow, and mischief. Probably not in that order. Too late, she clamped down the lid. Only one thing remained in the box. Hope. Hope, the story goes, was the only good the casket held among many evils, and it remains to this day mankind's sole comfort in misfortune. No mention here of action being a comfort in misfortune, or of actually doing something to alleviate or eliminate one's misfortune. The more I understand hope, the more I realize that all along it deserved to be in the box with the plague, sorrow, and mischief, that it serves the needs of those in power as surely as belief in a distant heaven, that hope is really nothing more than a secular way of keeping us in line. Hope is, in fact, a curse, a bane. I say this not only because of the lovely Buddhist saying, quote, hope and fear chase each other's tails, end quote. Not only because hope leads us away from the present, away from who and where we are right now and towards some imaginary future state. I say this because of what hope is. More or less all of us yammer on more or less endlessly about hope. You wouldn't believe, or maybe you would, how many magazine editors have asked me to write about the apocalypse, then enjoined me to leave readers with a sense of hope. But what precisely is hope? At a talk I gave last spring, someone asked me to define it. I turned the question back on the audience, and here's the definition we all came up with. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. It means you are essentially powerless. I'm not, for example, going to say I hope I eat something tomorrow. I just will. I don't hope I take another breath right now, nor that I finish writing this sentence. I just do them. On the other hand, I do hope that the next time I get on a plane, it doesn't crash. To hope for some result means you have given up any agency concerning it. Many people say they hope the dominant culture stops destroying the world. By saying that, they've assumed that the destruction will continue, at least in the short term, and they've stepped away from their own ability to participate in stopping it. I do not hope coho salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes to make sure the dominant culture doesn't drive them extinct. If coho want to leave us because they don't like how they're being treated, and who could blame them, I will say goodbye, and I will miss them. But if they do not want to leave, I will not allow civilization to kill them off. When we realize the degree of agency we actually do have, we no longer have to hope at all. We simply do the work.
We make sure salmon survive. We make sure prairie dogs survive. We make sure grizzlies survive. We do whatever it takes. When we stop hoping for external assistance, when we stop hoping that the awful situation we're in will somehow resolve itself, when we stop hoping the situation will somehow not get worse, then we're finally free, truly free, to honestly start working to resolve it. I would say that when hope dies, action begins. People sometimes ask me, if things are so bad, why don't you just kill yourself? The answer is that life is really, really good. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really, really effed, but at the same time, that life is really, really good. I'm full of rage, sorrow, joy, love, hate, despair, happiness, satisfaction, dissatisfaction, and a thousand other feelings. We are truly effed. Life is still really good. Many people are afraid to feel despair. They fear that if they allow themselves to perceive how desperate our situation really is, they must then be perpetually miserable. They forget that it is possible to feel many things at once. They also forget that despair is an entirely appropriate response to a desperate situation. Many people probably also fear that if they allow themselves to perceive how desperate things are, they may be forced to do something about it. Another question people sometimes ask me is, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? Well, the first answer is that I don't really like to party. The second is that I'm already having a great deal of fun. I love my life. I love life. This is true for most activists I know. We're doing what we love, fighting for what and whom we love. I have no patience for those who use our desperate situation as an excuse for inaction. I've learned that if you deprive most of these people of that particular excuse, they just find another, then another, then another. The use of this excuse to justify inaction, the use of any excuse to justify inaction, reveals nothing more nor less than an incapacity to love. At one of my recent talks, someone stood up during the Q&A and announced that the only reason people ever become activists is to feel better about themselves. Effectiveness doesn't really matter, he said, and it's egotistical to think it does. I told him I disagreed. Doesn't activism make you feel good? He asked. Of course, I said. But that's not why I do it. If I only wanted to feel good, I can just masturbate. But I want to accomplish something in the real world. Why? Because I'm in love with salmon, with trees outside my window, with baby lampreys living in sandy stream bottoms, with slender salamanders crawling through the duff. And if you love, you act to defend your beloved. Of course, results matter to you, but they don't determine whether or not you make the effort. You don't simply hope your beloved survives and thrives. You do what it takes. If my love doesn't cost me to protect those I love, it's not love. A wonderful thing happens when you give up on hope, which is that you realize you never needed it in the first place. You realize that giving up on hope didn't kill you. It didn't even make you less effective. In fact, it made you more effective because you ceased relying on someone or something else to solve your problems. You ceased hoping your problems would somehow get solved through the magical assistance of God, the Great Mother, the Sierra Club, valiant tree sitters, brave salmon, or even the earth itself, and you just began doing whatever it takes to solve those problems yourself. This is Derek Jensen talking and writing, and there's a little bit more here that I will share with you when we come back after this break. What Jensen is saying is that hope is ridiculous. Action is what's required. We'll be right back.
In your mind, you know that there's hope. It doesn't cost a thing to smile. You don't have to pay to laugh. You better thank God for that. There's hope. It doesn't cost a thing to smile. You don't have to pay to laugh. You better thank God for that. There's hope.
Every time I turn on the TV,
there's hope.
Somebody's acting crazy,
there's hope.
You let it, it'll drive you crazy,
there's hope.
I'm taking back my power today,
there's hope.
Gas prices, they just keep on rising,
there's hope.
The government, they keep on lying. We gotta keep on surviving. Keep living our truth and do the best we can do, cause there's
the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. The voice inside our heads right now is that of Derek Jensen, whose essay on the ridiculousness of hope, although he doesn't phrase it that way, but the ineffectiveness of hope, or the I give up attitude that is behind the word hope, finishing what he wrote. When you give up on hope, something even better happens than it not killing you, which is that in some sense it does kill you. You die. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that they, those in power, cannot really touch you anymore. Not through promises, not through threats, not through violence itself. Once you're dead in this way, you can still sing, you can still dance, you can still make love, you can still fight like hell, you can still live because you are still alive. More alive, in fact, than ever before. You come to realize that when hope died, the you who died with the hope was not you, but was the you who depended on those who exploit you, the you who believed that those who exploit will somehow stop on their own, the you who believed in the mythologies propagated by those who exploit you in order to facilitate that exploitation. The socially constructed you died. The civilized you died. The manufactured, fabricated, stamped, molded you died. The victim died. And what is left when that you dies? You are left. Animal you, naked you, vulnerable and invulnerable you, mortal you, survival you. The you who thinks not what the culture taught you to think, but what you think. The you who feels not what the culture taught you to feel, but what you feel. The you who is not who the culture taught you to be, but who you are. The you who can say yes. The you who can say no. The you who is part of the land where you live. The you who will fight or not to defend your family. The you who will fight or not to defend those you love. The you who will fight or not to defend the land upon which your life and the lives of those you love depends. The you whose morality is not based on what you've been taught by the culture that is killing the planet, killing you, but on your own animal feelings of love and connection to your family, your friends, your land base. Not to your family as self-identified civilized beings, but as animals who require a land base. Animals who are being killed by chemicals. Animals who have been formed and deformed to fit the needs of the culture. When you give up on hope, when you are dead in this way, and by so being, you are really alive. You make yourself no longer vulnerable to the co-option of rationality and fear that Nazis inflicted on Jews and others, that abusers like my father inflict on their victims, that the dominant culture inflicts on all of us. Or is it rather the case that these exploiters frame physical, social, and emotional circumstances such that victims perceive themselves as having no choice but to inflict this co-option on themselves? But when you give up on hope, this exploiter-victim relationship is broken. You become like the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. When you give up on hope, you turn away from fear. And when you quit relying on hope and instead begin to protect the people, things, and places you love, you become very dangerous indeed to those in power. And in case you're wondering, that's a very good thing. Derek Jensen, Beyond Hope, published in Orion Magazine. And thanks to Alice at Helen Howlers for sending that to me. I do appreciate it.
do appreciate it. This essay is one of those that kicks you in the ass and tries to wake you up. It is so difficult to stay awake, isn't it? I mean, that's one of the reasons I am so eager to be corrected on this program if I say something that some of you who are much more astute than I am about what's really going on, and you send me something, and it opens my eyes. Again, I don't mean to say I've been asleep all my life. I haven't. But it is so easy to be lulled into a coma. It's so easy to fall back on hope or wishes or God or some external thing or even some internal thing that serves to do nothing but take away our energy, take away our determination. I know that's so true for me. You know, I may say something or write something, and the right-wing trolls that just float, they're floaters. They're all over the place. And they'll snatch it off the internet, and they'll publish it someplace, and then the hate mail begins. I'll look at some of the postings, and I'll think, oh, my God. I mean, do I really hope that these people are someday going to croak and die? Do I really hope that reason and logic is going to prevail over these trolls? And, of course, the answer is, of course not. Of course not. They are what they are. They're on their path. And their path leads to one of those open holes in what we still have in the South around different places called an outhouse. And that's where they're going to wind up, which is fine with me. But I appreciate the fact that the people listening to this program will send things for me to read, either on the air or just to myself, to realign myself with what needs to be done. We'll be back after the break.
Tuned.
Listening to the Malloy program, and I certainly appreciate that. And you right-wingers, continue to listen. Something may happen where you'll fall down and choke to death. This hour is sponsored, well, my goodness, by the Malloy and Skype chat rooms. That's what it says, Malloy and Skype chat rooms, none. What? Posted by Greg. Message, thank you, Mike and Kathy, for all you do. We come here because we need your voice. What does that word none mean, Greg? The Malloy and Skype chat rooms, none. Nunn is your last name? Oh, okay. The Malloy chat room, you can go there. Just, what's the link? Go to MikeMalloy.com and you'll find it. You just sign in. tinyurl.com/MikeMalloyChat. tinyurl.com/MikeMalloyChat. Now, if you go there and you're a right winger, they will remove you very quickly. So mind your manners. The people who run that chat room, I don't run it. The people who do run it will give you a bad case of red ass if you don't mind your manners. You can say anything you want, but mind your manners. Well, that means you can't say anything you want. Now, that's difficult for right wingers, but you can try it. tinyurl.com/MikeMalloyChat. Sherry wrote, I think, is this from Sherry? Yeah. Sherry in Bremerton, Washington. Mike, I usually listen to your show from about 10 to midnight. The article you read last night concerning the seriousness of global warming and that it will be irreversible if there are no significant reductions in fossil fuel emissions by 2017 is, to me, terrifying because I see no possibility of any reductions. I think both Republicans and Democrats, including the president, are supporting increased use of fossil fuels. That's true. Obama has approved oil drilling in fragile environmental areas in Alaska, has done nothing to regulate fracking, and I think he will approve the XL pipeline. I'm afraid that because of the denial or stupidity, greed, and sociopathic behavior of our elected officials, we have been put in a hopeless situation. That's not necessarily a bad thing, apparently, Sherry. I am a 65-year-old legally blind woman who, with a guide dog, lives alone. My only income is Social Security, and my only medical coverage is Medicare. The Republican and Tea Party agendas has frightened me, frustrated me, and made me angry. The problems concerning global warming has terrified me. For the first time in my life, I'm glad to be elderly. I fear that our children and grandchildren will never see old age. They will have been murdered by our politicians and the stupid, religious, and selfish people who watch Fox and rely on the major TV networks for accurate information. I've written two short poems about what I think is happening in our world today. Would you be willing to read these on your radio program? I wish I could make a financial donation, but unfortunately, I am unable to do so. Sure, Sherry. Here's the first one, the disposable people. By some, they are considered the disposable people. They are the homeless, the mentally ill, the disabled. They are people who push shopping carts filled with meager belongings along cold, wet, and dirty sidewalks. They are the unfed and the unbathed. They carry cardboard signs begging for help. They are preyed upon, beaten, and ignored. Bearing memories that refuse to die, they become but a shadow cast by all that once was. They are the poor, unable to stretch a meager income. They are cold and hungry. They are uninsured, living today in fear and despair. They sacrifice dignity on the altar of corporate greed. They are the middle class. Once firm, their substance is now evaporating like water held to the fire of corporate values, a cancerous flame burning the soul of humanity. They are tethered and silenced, victims of a powerful force shifting the boundary of morality. They are the people not fitting the concept of white male privilege. They differ in race, ethnicity, values, beliefs, and sexual orientation. They are treated with contempt, suspicion, and denied the constitutional right of equality. Those who consider themselves the indisposable people, represented by corporate wealth, power, and greed, are, with little resistance, emerging like hungry parasites from a dark pit.
They are parasites with teeth gnawing on those who sleep with eyes closed in denial, hoping whom they consider the disposable people will not awaken. They quietly fill their bellies with hopes and dreams until human values are snuffed out like a candle flame between two fingers. Life is about compassion for our fellow human beings and about caring for the world that sustains us. Without that, we've lost our humanity. Sherry Burns. And then this one. By the way, can you imagine a teabagger writing something like that? Can you imagine a conservative? This one is titled The Ripple Effect. It is believed by many that despite our behavior, humanity will last forever. Behavior, though, like a stone cast into the water, creates a widening circle of ripples, eventually reaching the shore of destruction. While oil, wearing the shroud of death, spills from the ocean depths, we sleep beneath the comfortable darkness of apathy. The American dream, big, better, more, now, becomes a nightmare of black crashing waves, leaving a once vibrant world dark with decay. Ignoring the stone cast by corporate greed, we barely notice the sludge covering our feet as we dance in the rising tide, a tide with an insatiable appetite. Fed by denial, the tide surges, becoming a tsunami devouring the diversity of life. Our aquatic environment is, like the foundation of a house, a vital support to the fragile biodiversity of the food chain. Humanity, not its creator, is but one link. It is time to cast a new stone into the water, a stone of moral responsibility, creating a ripple effect of care, sustenance, and sustainability. Sherry Burns in Bremerton, Washington. Thanks, Sherry. Who's the guy Kathy does Prairie Home Companion? Garrison Keillor. Yeah, for a moment there, I felt like Garrison Keillor. You know, every day, at least here on our public radio station, at 5 before 11 in the morning, he does the Poets, what is that, Poets Corner? He does, among other things, this is a 5-minute little cut-in. Among other things, he quotes from a poem. It may be a poet that died 300 years ago, or it may be one who's teaching at University of Virginia. He ought to read Sherry Burns' poetry sometime. We'll be right back.
It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malone.
21 past the hour. All right, I want to do a little bit here on this insanity, this cultural insanity that's going on about Chick-fil-A. I'm not talking about the people who are protesting the bigotry and intolerance of the people who own this, but the insane support of bigotry and intolerance and stupidity that has been demonstrated in this country yesterday. It's astonishing. I knew I lived in an open-air asylum, but I didn't think it was this crazy here. Now, I realize the media made a big deal out of this, and I realize that I might have seen on television a total of maybe, 400 or 500 people lining the streets around these Chick-fil-A's, but I have a feeling that tens of thousands turned out to buy a goddamn chicken sandwich in honor of their sick, warped God. Their God that orders nations to be destroyed. Their God that sits back on his large ass and giggles when people are murdered by the millions. His own chosen people, as a matter of fact. If you believe in that God, you are one sick SOB. You really, truly are. But I digress. From Gordon in Oklahoma City, if anyone has been following the controversy hanging over a certain restaurant chain, they should be aware the boycott was not a result of the statements made by the CEO. The boycott is a result of donations made by this foul, F-O-U-L, management to anti-gay hate organizations. Groups that lobby Congress to stop condemnation of Uganda's Kill the Gays legislation, or groups that spread falsehoods about the LGBT community, or funds which find their way into the pockets of those calling for laws which would force reparative therapy on anyone who is gay or lesbian. I certainly don't want to indirectly spend my money knowing that I'm enabling such funding. The idea about freedom of speech is only a distraction, and the sheep fell for it, totally. I would lay odds that not one out of 100 in line at this chicken outfit has ever heard of a character named Rush Dooney or the Reconstructionist movement. If anything, this issue illuminates how important Jefferson's wall between church and state is to each of us. We must guard our freedoms despite mobs mindlessly following their leader's command on a false distraction. Gordon in Oklahoma City. Well, if your idea of a freedom of speech is to actively and openly support your phony-ass God and your phony-ass religion and your not-phony bigotry and consuming hatred and your arrogant condescension of people who happen to look exactly like you and live exactly the same life, except they don't happen to be heterosexual like you are. If that's who you are, you know, shame on you. Shame on you. You really, you do dishonor to your own so-called son of God. You dishonor him. You might as well urinate all over the next time you see a cross or Ten Commandments. You really might as well. But the sickness that this displays, the utter sickness. I saw some videos of people standing inside these restaurants holding up their Chick-fil-A sandwiches and laughing and shouting and clapping like, "Hey, we love our bigotry. We love our dumbassery. We love our stupidity. We're dumber than dog droppings. We love it. We're going to heaven and you're not." That's what it's like. Like a bunch of six-year-olds, no offense to six-year-olds. At lunch today, I had to explain, or I felt the need to explain to Molly what this is all about. The Chick-fil-A thing. Because I also had to tell her the other day, that's it, no more Chick-fil-A. Daddy! No. Let me tell you why. Why do they hate gay people, Daddy? Because they have a deep, unremovable sickness. That's why. But you know, try sometime. Try to explain to an eight-year-old. And I finished up by saying, you know, Molly, your mom and I have tried, like most parents have tried, to kind of keep the really ugly stuff out there in the world away from you, you know, to honor your innocence. I said, but you're getting older now. You're 8 years old. And Molly has all kinds of questions. And so we have to tell you the truth. And some of the truths that we tell you are not going to make you happy. You know, it's not like all the books you've read and all the paintings and little drawings you've made and hanging out with your little friends. It's a lot different out there, Molly.
Truth Seekers, Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malloy.
Before the hour, we're talking with Dr. Rick Stagenborg, who is the founder of SoldiersForPeaceInternational.org, and the object of one of the objects of that website is to organize people who will try to get into Congress, members who will vote for a constitutional amendment that will ban expenditures by special interest groups from elections. The reason I wanted you to stay over for a couple more minutes, Rick, is to ask you again how. Let me rephrase it, because I just sound so damn negative. What do you want people to do to affect this this effort that you've got going here for a constitutional amendment? What do you want people to do?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. Really, there's a lot of things that people can do. The most important thing people can do is go to campaign events where they have a chance to ask questions and ask the candidates if they'll make that pledge to amend. And if they don't have the chance to ask questions, stand outside with signs saying corporations are not people, ban special interest money from elections, or whatever. But this is, in addition to being the way that we can actually pass the amendment, in the process of doing it, we can educate people about this being the issue. And it's not a right-left issue. It's not a Republican-Democrat issue. This is a completely nonpartisan effort. Otherwise, I couldn't promote it through the nonprofit 501c3 Take Back America for the people.
Right.
So there's a lot of ways. If you know somebody who's running, talk to them. Let them know the power of using this as a central issue to build a campaign around, because nothing will appeal to a wider variety of people than the idea of permanently fixing getting corporate money out of politics. In particular, I'm also talking about union money, which is not as hard to sell as it sounds like. I've talked to a number of union leaders who agree you can't pass the amendment unless you include unions, and you're not going to get the conservative support you need.
The reality of the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling puts a cloud over the issue that you're trying to that you're trying to develop, doesn't it? I mean, Citizens United. You know, this is the part that gets me about Citizens United or any of these issues where they talk about banning special interest money, and they say, you know, corporations and unions, as if there were parity, as if there was some kind of balance between corporations and unions, which is asinine. That is crazy. Now, I understand your point. In order to get conservatives on board, you have to sacrifice something. So let's toss the union the union movement totally under the bus. It's practically dead anyway. But the comparison that there is, the idea that there is a comparison or equivalence between corporate money and union money is just galling to me.
I know. It used to irritate me too until I realized it wasn't important enough to get upset about. The fact of the matter is unions in the last election cycle put up $400 million versus $20 billion from the corporations. And that's not even counting how much the rich put out individually. So the unions already do not have power. We're not throwing them under the bus. We're getting them to admit reality. If they want to win this battle against corporatocracy, they're going to have to give up the petty power that really isn't getting them anything. All it's getting them is corporate Democrats who are just as dependent on that corporate money as the Republicans. So it's really not giving up anything for getting a heck of a lot.
Excellent point. Excellent point. For some reason, I hadn't considered it the way you just said it. Rick, thanks so much for being on the program again, and I hope a lot of people will visit the site. We'll talk again, okay?
Great. Thanks a lot, Mike.
All right. Take care, Rick.
Take care.
Go to his website, if you would, soldiersforpeaceinternational.org. Check it out. Just take a look. And go to the drop-down, or not the drop-down, but the button, Pledge to Amend Campaign. And take a look. Okay? Would you do that? Then you decide what to do beyond that. Just remember, I just want to share with you one more time here the mission statement that they have up there. Our mission is to join individuals and groups working in different ways to ensure that our children live in a rational, sustainable world. When enough people abandon the belief that war is inevitable, it will become unthinkable. War is conducted for corporate empire. Therefore, the first step to ending war is ending corporate control of the U.S. government. All social justice efforts lead to the end of war, the ultimate injustice. Those who work for justice are soldiers for peace. You know, I do have great respect for any type of progressive organization or any attempt to bring some kind of rationality, some kind of justice to what's going on in this country. But it sometimes feels, I don't know, just out of reach. From Prairie 2, Hide Your Marbles. The stock markets were down sharply today on reports that economic growth might be stalling. Then, after hours, one of the big credit rating agencies downgraded the top 15 U.S. banks. Guess what the markets will look like in the morning? These credit rating agencies are just lackeys to the very banks that they're downgrading. The banks have been showing massive profits for the past 3 years and awarding their executives $150 billion per year in bonuses. And now suddenly they need to have their creditworthiness brought into question? Now? The reason given is that analysts question these massive predatory banks' ability to make money in the future. It's as if they see something coming the rest of us missed. Did they unearth a new Mayan tablet that goes into detail about the end of the world? Oh, wait. There's something happening in November! If I could just remember what it is. A somewhat cynical person might think that the Wall Street banks fear that all the money they've invested in Mitt Romney isn't going to pay off, and they've come up with a way to hedge their bets. The corporate media is talking constantly about the fantastic costs this downgrade will add to borrowing if you can even get a loan. The Mayans were right. We're doomed. At least if the Republicans can drive down the economy sufficiently by November, we peasants will be. The question is just how far will they go? Will they completely crash the banks in order to freeze up the economy? It doesn't matter to them how much money they lose if they can seize the entire country. Then they can just print their own money. Will all the bills have portraits of Ronald Reagan on them the way the Queen is on Her Majesty's currency? I'm a little surprised that they're starting this early. But they do have people who can crunch the numbers. By October, will we see lines of people outside banks wanting their savings? Are there still people who have savings? Will the plastic in your wallet stop working? I have no idea, but you can bet that they are considering this. Even if Obama can keep the bankers under control, the damage they do will make Obama look bad just the same. He's probably starting to regret not putting them all in prison. Really, all the Republicans need to do is hang on to the Congress. The next four years will make the past 2 years seem like a picnic. Too bad that big asteroid missed us. It would have been so much easier to deal with. Maybe I'm being too pessimistic today. We'll see how many points the market drops tomorrow. If we start seeing daily updates on the news about how much our 401ks have dropped, then we'll know the corporations are really going for all the marbles. You know, the way the schoolyard bully just steps on your fingers and takes all the marbles. Prairie2.com. My, my, my. If it ain't piss ants, it's bed bugs. What? Oh, John Boehner, Speaker of the House. Huh? John Boehner? In the mold of the great Lyndon Baines Johnson, John Boehner? Guess what he's now telling rank-and-file Republicans? His office released a memo publicly today. And, who sent this to me? Miami Trucker. Miami Trucker sent me this, or I would have missed it altogether. I've discovered that I'm following the advice of a lot of people who operate in the Molloy chat room, a lot of people who just send me emails, and the consensus is always the same. Turn off your television! So I more or less have, and I missed this. Thanks, Miami Trucker. I'll share it with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy.
Here come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Molloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by the Molloy and Skype chat rooms. The message, thank you, Mike and Kathy, for all you do. We come here because we need your voice. This is, what, the 25th, 30th time they have sponsored an hour of this program. You guys are great. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Appreciate it. tinyurl.com/MikeMolloyChat if you want to test the fiber of the people in that chat room. God help you if you do. Whoa! Oh, by the way, I've been asked to announce that tomorrow is same-sex kiss day at Chick-fil-A nationwide. National Same-Sex Kiss Day at Chick-fil-A. I think that's wonderful. You know, in spite of all the bigotry and sickness of these right-wing Christian types, I think it would be nice if a lot of people showed up and kissed somebody of the same sex in a display of affection and respect and tenderness, not to mention a middle finger right in the face of these right-wing bigots. Tomorrow should be an should be an interesting day. Now, Chick-fil-A is not over the entire country, of course. Certain areas don't have one. Oh. Dave in Kentucky writes, Mike, I thought we were past all the ugliness folks like the former Georgia governor and chicken restaurant owner Lester Maddox represented. If he were alive today, apparently he'd be a bigger hero to these rednecks than he was at the time he was representing the last spike of Jim Crow before it was extinguished with the voting rights law. This Chick-fil-A thing ain't pretty at all. Dave in Kentucky. Yeah, I interviewed Lester one time when he was running for president. Got a picture on the wall here of a good friend of mine who went out to the Atlanta airport to pick his ass up and bring him to the studio. This is when I worked for a big-time radio station, WSB. But Lester was one sick puppy in more ways than one. I mean, he had testicular cancer, I think. Where'd he go? To Cuba to get treated? Cuba? I think it was Cuba. Of course, he's dead now. But yeah, Lester had a restaurant here in Atlanta called the Pick Rick Cafe. And in the early 70s, because I remember 70, 71, 69, 68, this old rancid son of a bitch would take an axe handle, one of the great big old lumbermen axe handles. And if African American showed up at his restaurant to get a piece of chicken, what is it about chicken and these white bigots? Lester would come out with his axe handle and chase people away. Boy, you better get out of here. I ain't serving no chicken to you people. Get out of here. Civil rights, my ass. Get out of here. I was always afraid that someday, you know, somebody African-American would show up and do some damage to Lester Maddox's axe handle. So, in the spirit of Lester Maddox, we now have Dan Cathy, who is determined to... I mean, what a way to get publicity, right? Is there anybody in America that hasn't heard now of Chick-fil-A? Of course, it's forever associated with bigotry and stupidity and arrogance, condescension. In other words, your typical Christian attitude these days. I don't want to talk about this too much anymore. When we come back after this break, a little bit more from Bill McKibben. He was on Democracy Now! Today. As you know, McKibben has that piece in Rolling Stone, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. And we talked about it the other night. He's also the co-founder and director of 350.org. The 350 represents parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That unless we get it to that point, according to a lot of scientists, we are in... we are on a straight line to extinction. Oh, I know. That's just exaggerated nonsense talk. I know. Hell, I can find you one or two Earth scientists out of 17,000. I'll tell you that's not true. So anyway, McKibben has some comments about fracking. You know, remember what Mueller, Dr. Mueller, the guy who was funded by the Koch brothers to do a study on climate change global climate, earth warming, whatever you want to call it, planet heating. And so Professor Mueller did the study, and he came out in the New York Times earlier this week, or was it last week, where he said, yeah, it's happening. It's probably going to be irreversible, and it's man-made. Ooh! That's $150,000 that the Koch brothers didn't get a very good return on, did they? But anyway, Mueller went on to say that we have to move to natural gas. We have to find out a way to frack safely. We'll be right back. 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy Program. The phones are open if you'd like to call in. 877-996-2556. If you are a right-winger, either religious or politically, and you want to call this program, I will tell you, before you even call, mind your manners. I'm inviting you into my place of business. If you can conduct yourself like a responsible human... What am I saying? Never mind. Frank is in Westland, Michigan, listening on Sirius. Hello, Frank.
Hi, Mike. I know you've kind of let it go about the Lester Maddox thing, but I just was dying to ask you, do you remember when Maddox appeared on the Dick Cavett show back when all this was big news with the Pickwick?
And he walked off?
Well, Dick Cavett let him have pretty much full expression of opinion.
Yeah.
And then Cavett brought on a mystery guest who was Jim Brown.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, oh, you did? Okay, I wondered if anybody remembered about me, but it got kind of testy. And I got to say, I felt sorry for Maddox. He was... looked to me to be scared out of his wits.
Oh, he looked like this little shriveled up Caucasian scarecrow next to Jim Brown. This is in Jim Brown's heyday when he was an actor and football player and blah,
right.
blah, blah.
And at some point, Jim, and I'm going to end this with this, but Jim Brown said something. He was getting pretty testy with Maddox.
Right.
And he said, if you think those two State Patrolmen, state troopers you've got back there as bodyguards are going to be any protection, something to the effect of you're sadly mistaken.
Yeah.
It was really hostile. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in.
I had forgotten that. I didn't see it when it happened, but I certainly have seen the old kinescope or the, I don't think they had tape back then, the film recordings of that. It was a great moment in television history. Thanks, Frank.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
And take care. Jim Brown and this little shriveled up Lester Maddox. God. Ah. McKibben was on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman today. And Amy asked him to synopsize global warming, where it stands today and what needs to be done. McKibben said the following. Look, we're really seeing the summer around the world despite what Dr. Mueller was peddling a minute ago. What climate change looks like in its early stages. And it's been a pretty scary summer, not just here in this country where we're seeing epic heat and drought. But up in Greenland, maybe the most important place in the world where the science and the actualities of what's going on are sort of clearer day by day by day. We're seeing record melts. We're seeing snow turning to water and soaking up more of the sun's heat. It's been a ragged summer. And the point of my piece in Rolling Stone, which, oddly enough, though it's fairly mathematical, has gone kind of viral, the point of it is we now know enough to know what the future holds unless we change fast. The piece points out that scientists have long told us that if we want to stay below 2 degrees warming, which is what every government in the world, even the most conservative, have adopted as the bottom line, we can only burn 565 more gigatons of carbon. Unfortunately, a new analysis by a bunch of UK financial analysts showed that the fossil fuel industry and those countries that kind of operate like the fossil fuel industry, you know, Venezuela or Kuwait, have in their reserves 2,795 gigatons of carbon in the form of coal and gas and oil. That's still below ground, but economically it's essentially above ground. They're borrowing against it. Their share prices are based on it. And unless we change things very dramatically, it's going to get burned, and we are going to overwhelm the climate system. And so we are going to need to stand up to that industry. That's the bottom line. Then Amy Goodman says, your assessment of Mueller's conversion, as he describes it, now saying that global warming is human-caused. McKibben says, scientifically, it's not very interesting because, you know, most scientists figured it out 20 years ago. All he has done is confirm their work. Politically, it's interesting because we're reaching the point where even the kind of industry-funded deniers can't with a straight face say that it's not warming. In fact, Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, 2 weeks ago, probably more importantly, said, yes, forget all the things that my predecessors have said about how global warming was a hoax. Global warming is real, and we're causing it. That was Rex Tillerson, Exxon CEO. He then went on to say, but it's an engineering problem with engineering solutions. And the example that he gave was, if we need to move our crop production areas, we will. By crop production areas, I think he means what the rest of us call farms. And if you look at an atlas, there is really not a lot of room to move them. You can't take an Iowa cornfield, where we're not going to grow any corn this year because of the heat and drought, and somehow transplant it up to the melting Arctic tundra, because when you get up there, there's no soil. What needs to be adapted is not our crop production areas. What needs to be adapted are the business plans of the fossil fuel industry. They need to stop exploring for more hydrocarbons. They need to stop warping our democracy by buying off the House and the Senate. And instead, we need to put, the most obvious thing to do, what every economist for 20 years has been saying, is put a stiff price on carbon to reflect the damage that it does. And that's one of the things we work on at 350.org. And by the way, if you haven't been to the website, you should check it out. Bill McKibben, one of the voices being raised about these issues, along with voices like Bob Kincaid, who has an online radio program that you should be listening to, headonradionetwork.com. Bob Kincaid works on the issue of the destruction, immediate and long range, caused by the coal industry with mountaintop removal. So if you haven't gone to Bob Kincaid's website and listened to his program, then please do it. HeadOnRadioNetwork.org. And some of you right-wingers, I know that it's very difficult for you to listen to me. Kincaid can get inside your head a lot better than I do. You know, he's much more polite. He'll kill me for saying that. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Bob Kincaid. His whole family, his wife, his three children, are activists around this issue. Nobody wants to talk tonight, Kathy? No calls? Okay. Well, I guess these right-wingers are right. You know, we only have 9 listeners. We're insignificant. Huh? All my listeners called yesterday? Okay. Well, if there are any stragglers out there, the number is 877-996-2556. These right-wing toads just crack me up. Big anniversary coming up. I guess you're aware of that. August 6th. Here it is again. Yes, indeed. I'll probably wait on this, but Noam Chomsky has a brief piece in Hiroshima's Chateau. What else we got? I don't know. We got a bunch of stuff. All right, 877-996-2556 if you want to chat. We'll be right back.
Noise Show, because each time you listen to Right Wing Radio, God kills a kitten.
Oh, really? Oh, by the way, in speaking or in talking about Bob Kincaid, I want you to check out one of the websites he's involved in. There is something that was introduced by a piece of legislation introduced by several members of the House, all Democrats. It was called the ACHE, A-C-H-E Act. ACHE stands for Appalachian Communities Health Emergency. Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. Bob Kincaid was real instrumental, although he would probably deny it. I don't know, maybe he wouldn't deny it, but he was very instrumental in getting this into the hands of these Democratic members of the House. It has been introduced. We'll see what happens. But there's a website, stoptheache.org. Stoptheache, A-C-H-E, dot org. Stoptheache.org. So you might want to go there, check it out. And thanks to one of our listeners, Renee Louise, who reminded me of that. Now, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago when Bob was got back from D.C., but Renee is right. I should mention it more often. Stoptheache.org. Check it out. Check it out, for real. Phone calls. Gary is in Minneapolis listening on KTNF. Hello, Gary.
All right, I got in before any potential right-wingers. I'm happy.
Okay.
Wanted to give you the info that I didn't get a chance to last week because I didn't have enough time. About 2 weeks ago, on Bill Moyers, they had Chris Hedges for about an hour, most of the hour.
Uh-huh.
I guess he's got a new book out, and one of the subjects they talked about was these, what I think they called them like dead zones. They had like five areas in the country, and one of them was Camden, New Jersey, where everything is dying. Another one was Pine Ridge, South Dakota, where the Indian Reservation is, and I guess they walk like a couple miles across the border to like Nebraska or something, and there's extensive alcoholism that really screws
right.
things up there. And one of the five was about West Virginia, and it was basically along the lines of what Bob Kincaid is trying to do.
And that is to stop mountaintop removal.
Yep, they talked about the destruction, about how it's the lungs of that part of the country,
mm-hmm.
and how you can't get it back. They kind of touched on that and stuff. And you can find it online. I think you can watch the whole show at the PBS site, and you can also download the audio for free at iTunes. So anybody that didn't find out about it a couple weeks ago and missed it has a chance to see it. And I would highly recommend for you and anybody else that's interested to check it out, because a lot of the things that he does on his show fits the narrative of what you talk about on the radio. So if somebody wants a TV show that's accessible that you don't have to pay for on cable, check that show out on a regular basis.
It's Bill Moyers on PBS.org.
Yeah, they show it every Friday here in mm-hmm. Minnesota, and then they rerun it a couple of times. And I would assume that's the same around the country. It's like that block where you have the Washington Week, which is, if you don't like Press the Meat, that's a lot better show because the people interact with each other, and then they have Need to Know, which talks about illegal immigration. They show the abuses by the people and stuff. That's a really good block if you don't have MSNBC or you're sick of MSNBC, and it fits the narrative of what you're doing. So I would highly recommend that stuff.
Okay. Well, Gary, thank you.
No problem.
All right.
See you soon.
All right, sir. Take care. I don't know how many of you know what I know most people listen to this program do. Everybody listens to Kincaid knows what mountaintop removal is. It is what it sounds like. And it's being perpetrated against the people in Appalachia by the coal companies. And they have framed the issue in a manner that if you are opposed to the blowing off of the tops of mountains and the subsequent destruction of the environment, then you are against jobs. This is what these right-wing sons of bitches have done across the board. Anything that they propose, if you oppose it, you are against jobs. If they want to invade Iran and you say no, you're against jobs. If you want to stop people from getting married, you are against jobs. If you don't want genetically altered crap in your grocery store, you're against jobs. Have you noticed that? Every single issue has been framed. You're against jobs, aren't you? We'll be back after the break. Stay with us.
Dodging glances on the train.
Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. A couple of great graphics are making their way around the web. One is, a shot of a Chick-fil-A someplace with this huge line of white people from yesterday who are there to display their bigotry. And across the graphic, it says, you'd never see that many Christians lined up to help at a food bank or a homeless shelter. And that's something Jesus actually said to do. Isn't that the truth? And then the other one that I really like is, it's a standard picture of a Caucasian Jesus, sitting there with his head in his hands and a look of despair on his face. And the caption says, OMFG, you guys. I said I hated figs. Oh, my God. But that is so true, isn't it? All those people lined up to display their bigotry by buying a goddamn chicken sandwich. I mean, I've never heard of such insanity in my life. But there they are. And whoever came up with the caption, you never see that many Christians lined up in the searing heat to help out at a homeless shelter or a food bank. Isn't that the truth? Another reason to say to you Christians, shame on you. Just shame on you. Shame on you. How can you profess to be followers of this man Jesus who hated figs, not fags? He made it very clear. But I how can you do that? How can you turn out in the thousands to display openly and with pride and with your children your disgusting bigotry? How do you do that? I sit here and struggle to explain to my 8-year-old what this is all about and to let her know how vile and filthy it is. And you will take your 8-year-old to participate in this kind of garbage. How do you justify that? Where did your Jesus tell you to do that? But this is how bigotry and hatred is spread. It's the only way it's spread. It's from you adults. you right-wing so-called Christians, you right-wing political morons, just feeding and pumping this into your kids. Shame on you. Shame, shame, shame on you. And what are some of you going to do when your child grows up and realizes he or she is gay? What are you going to do? Disown him or her? What are you going to do when your precious baby that you raised, that you conceived and you raised, and your precious baby becomes an adult, and somebody grabs her and drags her into an alley and beats the hell out of her because she's a lesbian? What are you going to do? You're the one who set this up. You're the one with your crappy-ass religion that insisted on displaying your bigotry toward gay folk. What are you going to do if your son turns out to be gay and someday he's coming home from, oh, I don't know, graduate school, and a couple of rednecks grab him and kill him because he's gay? What are you going to do then? Are you going to go to church, and at his funeral, are you going to beg God's forgiveness, your God's forgiveness for what you did? You helped set up your own child's death. Shame on you? Nah, not shame on you. Pity on you. Pity on you. Man, I don't understand. I don't even want to try. But I see those pictures. I didn't see one black person. Not that that matters. I'm just saying. But all these white folks lined up to display their bigotry with their kids. Their kids, for Christ's sake. Their kids! Yeah, you gotta hate these people here, Junior. These queers. And I sit here with my kid trying desperately to explain to her what's going on and why it's going on. But Daddy, why do they hate gay people? Whew. You try to answer that to a kid who has absolutely no corruption from religion. None. You try to explain that. And if you can think of a way to do it, let me know. Man. Don is driving in North Dakota listening on Sirius. Hello, Don.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. This is more kind of, it's kind of a weird science thing. So it's just going backwards a little bit.
Okay.
But, They had a story on the BBC's Science and Environment stream on the phone app, which is how I get my BBC news.
Mm-hmm.
And a team of scientists has drilled this real, real deep sediment core
mm-hmm.
out of Antarctica. It goes all the way back to the Eocene, which is like 53 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there were freaking palm trees in Antarctica.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, the idea of a continental drift or plate tectonics, there used to be just one continent, Pangaea, I believe it was called, one landmass.
Yeah.
That existed on this planet and then started, then began the continental drift or plate tectonics. So I'm not the least bit surprised. I believe at one time Antarctica, as we now call it, was either at the equator or near it. So it's not the least bit surprising.
Oh, no, it was where it is now in the Eocene.
Oh, yeah?
And there were palm trees. The winter daily temperature, according to this article, was an average of about 10 Celsius, which would work out to 40 something. And the average summer daily temperature was 25, which is like up in the high 80s, low 90s.
Yeah.
This was a greenhouse era, like we're talking about two at that time. Again, according to the article, it was about 10 ppm more carbon dioxide than there is now.
Yeah.
What gets to me is, I mean, if it's hitting high 80s and low 90s in Antarctica, do you even want to think about the Valley of the Sun in Arizona? You know, I mean, it boggles the mind. And it's happening. Like, my youngest daughter just spent the winter months, like from December through March, up in Yellowknife, in Northwest Territories. The average temperature all winter long was 20-ish, minus 20 Celsius, which, that's a crossover point. That's also minus 20 Fahrenheit. The norm for up there, at that time of the year, is more like minus 40 to minus 50. It actually hit zero one day. I mean, she was walking around without a hat.
You know? Well, I think what you're showing or talking about, Don, I don't think there's any doubt about what's going on. I think the only people who just can't accept it, cannot accept it, I would assume because of fear or because of a sense of no control, because they recognize that individually there's not a damn thing they can do. Recycling your soup cans is not going to do anything. Putting out the little blue bin and recycling your newspapers is not going to do anything either. We're at the point where it takes some radical action. Thanks, Don. I appreciate what you had to say. Kevin is in Tucson listening on XM. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, Mike. How's it going tonight?
Fair to partly cloudy. How about you?
Yeah, same here. Now, you mentioned the other day and kind of the same thoughts that I had about this Dr. Mueller, who suddenly had a born-again moment where he now believes that, climate change is real. Well, something about this whole thing just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute I heard it, I just got this really strange feeling inside that this just wasn't right. Now, here's a few facts that I learned. So I listen to the radio all day long. I deliver camper trailers for a living. So,
hey, can you hold on? Kevin, can you hold on a second?
Yeah.
All right, we got to do some commercials here. Take a break here. We'll be back. So stay right there, Kevin. That sounded pretty bossy. Can you please stay right there, Kevin? Tucson. Okay, where were we?
Okay, we're on this Dr. Mueller, and when I heard it, as I mentioned before, it just didn't seem right. And here's some of the things that I've learned by listening to some interviews with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said he originally formed this little investigation group with his daughter, and it grew from there into a staff of 12 people who supposedly spent 3 years doing all of this research.
Mm-hmm.
Now, supposedly they were given a grant of $150,000 by one of the cokeheads.
Right.
Now, right there, that doesn't make any sense. How could somebody run a staff of 12, do all of this investigation work for 3 years, on $150,000.
Well, I think the $150,000 was just part of what he had. Don't forget, he's a physics professor at in the California University system. Huh?
Yeah, at Stanford. Yeah, he works at Stanford.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. You know, there's a possibility there's some other help there. Now, but the thing is, why isn't David Koch going through the roof about this guy and his findings? Unless I've missed it, I haven't heard anything from David Koch about, you know, disputing his facts, disputing the guy's credibility, because, you know, they should be going through the roof, you know, just yelling.
Well, yeah, but I think the Koch brothers, or whichever one of them, would say something. Would make themselves out to be total morons. And if there's one thing that people that have the kind of arrogance that the Koch brothers have, it's the one thing they can't stand is to be mocked. And since they hired this, well, they didn't hire him, since they contributed money to this guy, if they opened their traps now and said, wait a minute, it would make them look like total morons. And like I said, there's one thing the ultra or the super rich can't stand, and that's to be mocked. And I think they would be mocked in a very direct, critical way. So I think that's the answer. As far, Kevin, as the research that he did, he's a physicist, and this sort of thing comes under the within the scope of what he does at Stanford, I guess. So, but anybody can contribute something to someone who's working in research, as I'm sure you know. Any organization, any company, any individual, you know, can contribute to the work that the person is doing. So, but I agree with you completely that there is something that stinks about this, and I'm not sure what it is. Kevin, thanks. I got to move on. I appreciate what you had to say. Thank you, sir. Mark is in El Paso, listening on XM.
Hey, good evening, Mike.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, I'm just, you know, the climate change is so obvious. There's a huge drought in the Midwest. It's not getting the media as it should. And we talked about these Chick-fil-A right wing. What's going to happen when a Chick-fil-A sandwich costs $10? And the writing is so on the wall.
it really is. I mean, the whole thing is madness when you stop and think about it, Mark. We are faced with some really, really, really serious issues. And for all these people to turn out in support of a bigoted, nasty, unchristian, unchristlike statement made by the president of Chick-fil-A, I mean, it's one thing to just go ahead and condemn his ass and don't buy any more Chick-fil-A's from this freak. But for people who are offended, for people who want to support him, okay, go ahead and keep buying your Chick-fil-A's. But to have people turn out like this, these huge lines, and like I pointed out, that graphic that's making its way around the web, too bad Christians don't turn out in these numbers to work at a food pantry or to help the homeless or work in a soup kitchen, but they would never do that. These are Christians who I think Christ would kick to the curb. Well, no, he probably wouldn't. I mean, if you believe the mythologies about Jesus, he would probably gather these people in his arms and whisper to each one of them, I said figs, not fags. But you never know what might happen. Mark, I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. I appreciate you checking in. What to say? Don't forget, the next chapter in this debate over Chick-fil-A and the opposition to gay marriage by the CEO is tomorrow, when folks are planning a kiss-in event. I love it. It's called National Same-Sex Kiss Day at Chick-fil-A. Couples are encouraged to go to one of the chicken restaurant's locations and take a photo or video of themselves kissing. That's all.
organizers said on the Facebook page, quote, let's show Chick-fil-A thanks for their support of love, equality, and the real definition of marriage. Invite your friends. Oh, God. I don't know. This L.A. Times blog quotes somebody in Lake Forest, Illinois, Deanna Kirchen. She stood in line with her children to support the restaurant for religious reasons, she says. She's quoted as saying, I've been in line for over an hour. I'm only about three quarters of the way through. I'm hungry. And yes, we came here for lunch, but I wanted to support Chick-fil-A for having the cojones to stand up for biblical values. Oh, my. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.